Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian here on OWL Radio. Our first article, as you all may recall, since Smithsonian covers such a broad variety of topics, this first one, though, is a little bit of geography and a little bit of hydrology, because it's about the Inland Passage and one section of it in the south. The subtitle says it's encountering a long-forgotten waterway in the south that tormented many enslaved people and yet helped some escape to freedom. This is an article written by Imani Perry. Quite interesting little known topic. Particularly of interest if anyone is very familiar with South Carolina and their coastal setup. But then for those of us who aren't, we're going to learn some things today. The low country is emerald green and lacing gray. The landscape is visceral. Movement never ceases. Look from the sky and it appears as though the water has run veiny through the earth, making islands of a common ground. To get from Charleston, South Carolina, one of the old cities of the low country, to St. Augustine, Florida, one can go along the coastline, traversing the shallow waters of the Atlantic Ocean. There's another waterway, though, an interconnected series of rivers and hand-dug canals made possible because of slavery. It is slower, safer, and a historical treasure. Virginia McGee Richards has spent the past 10 years studying and documenting it. She calls it the Inner Passage. That would be as opposed to the Inland Passage. When I speak to her over Zoom, she is gracious, even self-effacing, but her curiosity is luminous. I see her eyes travel up into the sky of her imagination as she describes the majesty of the land. Her project includes interviewing local residents and editing a poetry collection written by local students reflecting on the history of the Inner Passage. She has collaborated with historians like Duke University's Peter H. Wood, the author of a seminal book about colonial South Carolina called Black Majority. Richards herself is a diligent researcher, a historian, and an environmental lawyer, as well as an award-winning photographer. To make these images, she used a mid-19th century photo process called wet plate, collodion. My hope, she says, is that images can convey a landscape scarred with secrets, river baptisms, planting seasons, torture, dancing, prayers, African dialects, poverty, massacres, lynching. The land remembers but cannot speak. By documenting the Inner Passage, I want to give the land a voice, she said. She swam its waters first, immersing herself near her home in South Carolina, became a ritual as she began to photograph the area and uncover its story. What she found was under-recognized and fascinating. The public's image of the South tends to hover in the 1800s when cotton was king. But the Inner Passage belongs to an earlier colonial Southland, a region that was part of America's becoming. It was often quite unbecoming in the process. Starting in the 1600s, British settlers forced enslaved people to build and maintain these waterways to support trade in deerskins and timber, and later rice and cotton. These men shoveled mud through malarial swamps while battling snakes and alligators in intense heat, Richards says. The passage grew to be 300 miles long and was eventually incorporated into the Intercoastal Waterway, which still exists today. As early as 1687, the Inner Passage also became a route for black freedom seekers. Long before the Underground Railroad opened up a pathway to the north, enslaved people in Charleston were paddling wooden boats through the Inner Passage, fleeing southward to Spanish-owned lands. Once they reached Florida, they were granted their freedom in exchange for converting to Catholicism. Their descendants were able to live there in relatively relative liberty until the 19th century, when Florida was annexed by the United States. As a daughter and a student of the South, I looked at Richard's images and find myself having flashbacks of events I never experienced firsthand. Take the live oaks growing along the canals. Over the course of 200 years, Richards says, these trees absorbed the sight of angled elbows against the land, backs arched, as hundreds of men sacrificed their lives to carve canals from the swamp. The trees saw black men burrow so deeply into the gray marsh that they disappeared into it. These oaks are the only creatures still alive today that witnessed these sights, and by looking at them, we witness their testimony. They tell us of the people who sheltered in their branches or behind their thick brown trunks, breathing heavily, wet with sweat, dew on the grass and moisture in the air. There was one oak whose trunk has grown around cinder blocks. Nature is a living graveyard. What has eroded is tended to by what remains. This dance between past and present moves through the entire collection of images. A photograph taken on the banks of the Stono River recalls the 1739 uprising of enslaved people, referred to as the Stono Rebellion. Led by an Angolan man named Jemmy, the group was defeated at Edisto River. Its members were killed or sold in the Caribbean. More repression and rebellions followed in slave societies everywhere. In a photograph taken near Jacksboro, South Carolina, we see the ruins of the Ponpon Chapel of Ease. Erected in 1725 and replaced in brick by 1754, that church was then destroyed by fire in 1801 and came to be known as Burnt Church, a name that was classically Southern, idiosyncratic, and matter of fact. It carried that designation until it was rebuilt between 1819 and 1822. Then it was mysteriously destroyed again in 1832. For nearly two centuries, the ruins have remained. So do the praise houses, simple wooden structures built by and for enslaved people. The church was the first institution of Black American life, before enslaved people had property or even a right to domesticity. Praise houses served as places of religious intercession, exhortation, and devotion, and also as sites for conflict resolution, political development, and education. The contrast between the rubble of the Ponpon Chapel of Ease and the carefully maintained praise houses makes me think of two words, ruins and runt. Ruins are detritus. Runt, a Southern vernacular term, and that is spelled R-U-I-N-T, is a reference to having been destroyed by disgrace and often sexual violation. To be runt was one of the many forces of violence experienced by the enslaved. the Praise House served as a place for spirit cleansing and new life. Many of these structures are still being sustained with tender attention today. The inner passage winds through the Combabi River, a small blackwater tributary that is good for bream fishing. Some of these fish are red-breasted, gleaming like fire when pulled up from the water. The Combabi is where Harriet Tubman, the woman called Moses, led black Union soldiers as they freed 700 enslaved people. Three Union gunboats traveled up the river, covertly gathering information along the way. The freedom seekers were waiting for them when they stopped at appointed locations. Richard's photographs taken on the bank of the Combabi function as a subtle memorial. The scenery is haunting when you think about the greed for wealth, the trade in flesh, the way a body could be swallowed up by the landscape. But this is a pretty place. Nature has covered the grounds where people died in war or fell to their knees in tears for freedom with a lush carpet of flora. The fauna still dance. The waters still flow. The people who live on the islands of the Inner Passage also carry history in their faces. Francis Maybank, a white man and a native of Charleston and Jehosee Island, stares at Richard's camera with pale eyes, a sun-weathered face, white hair combed back. Kathy Holmes, a native of James Island, is a black woman with chiseled features, hair drawn back, hooded eyes, gleaming skin. They belong alongside each other in any honest story of what this place is. Witness them both fully and our maps become more accurate, our national story truer. And then there is the image of a little girl, Annalena Hams, barely out of toddlerhood, but with a knowing face and a stern brow. Her ancestors first arrived in Charleston in 1683. She is the inheritor of a place that is fraught and breathtaking. To borrow from that sagacious thinker James Baldwin, I wonder what we will do with all this beauty. What will we do for her? The land insists that we tell the whole story, riotous and chaotic, beautiful and terrible. Richard's photograph reminds us to hold its legacy with care. Well, that's a fascinating little snippet of information of the Inner Passage along the edge of South Carolina that has been of historic and geographic significance for almost 300 years. That fascinating article was taken from the Smithsonian Magazine of March 2022. And now we're moving on to the next issue, which is April and May combined. And this first article is in the prologue section, and it's category, they are calling it Building History. This is kind of an interesting, so many of the topics in Smithsonian are about obscure bits of information that most of us wouldn't come across or come along if it weren't for this magazine, or unless you were in that area or that field. This is Paris on the Potomac. Paris, as in France, on the Potomac, as in Washington. The subtitle is The American Visionaries Rebuilding Parts of Notre Dame Using 12th Century Tools. This is written by Douglas Starr. The roof of Notre Dame de Paris was still burning in April 2019 when Rick and Laura Brown got a call from their daughter, Rian, a documentary filmmaker and professor at Oberlin College. "This sounds like a project for you," she said. "Let us think on it," Rick replied, which usually means yes. The Browns are at the forefront of a field called experimental archaeology, recreating ancient objects using the tools and techniques of those eras. Fascinating approach. Their main goal is education, teaching their students at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design to recreate age-old monuments and more. The object itself is loaded with information, Rick says. You don't understand it until you reverse engineer it and experience the process. The couple met while studying sculpture at the University of Georgia in the early 1970s. After graduating, they bounced around the country in academia, eventually settling in Boston. Fascinated by New England's architectural history, they joined the Timber Framers Guild, a 1,400-member group devoted to the old-fashioned craft of building structures with beams and joints held together by wooden pegs. In 1998, Grig Mullen Jr., a civil engineer and retired professor at the Virginia Military Institute, who has worked with the Browns since their earliest projects, put out a call for volunteers to recreate a full-sized medieval trebuchet, a kind of catapult, and the period's most fearsome weapon. The Browns took part in the workshop, and on the flight back to Boston, Rick sat next to PBS Nova producer Michael Barnes, who asked Rick if he thought he could recruit timber framers from the workshop to help assemble more weapons for a Nova program, Secrets of Lost Empires. The show culminated with participants raising two full-sized trebuchets next to a castle on the shores of Loch Ness in Scotland. Other historical questions followed. How did medieval craftsmen lift the enormous stones used to build castles? Working off old manuscripts and illustrations, the Browns collaborated with timber framers from the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Czech Republic to build human-powered cranes consisting of timbers, ropes, pulleys, and wooden hamster wheels big enough for a person to walk in. The Browns also helped build another crane to make repairs on the 14th-century Tochnik Castle outside Prague, which sits on a platform too small for today's mechanized cranes. The Browns' longest undertaking involved the Gwazdziek Synagogue, built by Polish Jews in the 1650s and destroyed by Nazis in the 1940s. Through their nonprofit organization, Hans House Studio, the Browns assembled teams of carpenters, students, and volunteers to build a replica of the synagogue's timber frame roof. On the underside, they recreated its painted ceiling, exuberantly decorated with Hebrew letters, animals, and vibrant geometric designs, using paints they'd made similar to those used by the original painters in the 14th century. Along the way, the Browns transported the ceiling panels to seven different cities in Poland, inviting Polish students to join the painting team. By the time the roof was finished in 2014, more than 300 students, carpenters, and artists had taken part. The result was permanently installed at the Poland Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. It's more than recovering an object, Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblet, program director of the Jewish Historical Institute of Poland, said of the project in a 2014 documentary, it's recovering a world. The burning of the Notre Dame Cathedral in April 2019 inspired the Browns and their students to launch a new international educational project. After two-thirds of the cathedral's roof and most of its spire were consumed by the flames, Carpenters Without Borders, a French group, held that the structure should be rebuilt using medieval methods, an argument the group eventually won. The Browns offered to help demonstrate the potential of experimental archaeology in this singular case, a gesture of goodwill and solidarity. In response, the French carpenters sent them the plans for Truss 6, a supporting structure that hung over the choir. Estimated to have been built in 1180, the truss was one of the oldest features of a cathedral that took nearly two centuries to build, starting in 1163. The School of Architecture and Planning at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., agreed to host the project as part of a summer course. In May 2021, Mez Welsh, a member of the Timber Framers Guild, got permission from Virginia landowners to chop down some white oak trees and drag them out with horses. In late July and early August, several dozen timber framers and students gathered to fashion the truss. The lawn next to the university's basilica became a pre-industrial work site. Workers stood lengthwise along the 40-foot-long tree trunks lying horizontal across wooden supports, and the team scored wedge-shaped perforations into the sides with a felling axe, a heavy-headed tool with a blade ideal for cutting cross-grain into wood. Once they'd completed that job, the workers pivoted and chopped along the length of the trunk, chipping away the wood between the wedged openings to create a flat surface. For this task, they used axes, some beveled on one side and flat on the other. Thus, a team of humans did the work of a sawmill, transforming a raw trunk into a rough-hewn wooden beam. Next, the volunteers used chisels, small axes, and saws to create the joinery that would hold the notched timbers together. Hollowed-out boxes called mortises and tenons, the wooden plugs that would fit into those boxes. Some of the workers' children pitched in, helping their parents use clamps and draw knives to shave the pieces to the correct dimensions. The work site was quiet. There were no roaring engines, no screaming saws, no percussive cracks of air-powered nail guns, just the chuck-chuck of axes and the murmur of conversation. On the 10th day, dozens of people stood alongside the beams and began to line up all the joints, following the crew chief's instructions. The workers used muscle power, mallets, ropes, and winches to pull the pieces together, then sealed the deal by banging wooden bolts called clavettes into place with mallets. It was as if they were assembling a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle where each piece weighed hundreds of pounds and all the pieces had to fit together simultaneously. Finally, the time came to hoist the finished triangular truss upright. The crew assembled two 24-foot-tall timber A-frames and fastened them to the base of the triangle. The truss weighed 4 tons and would stand 36 feet tall once the team hoisted it gently to the sky. Hoisting it too forcefully would cause it to topple forward. Another danger, attaching the hoist ropes to the wrong point on the triangle, could cause the structure to buckle and the pieces that held it together to pop apart. "It's basically a sophomore-level course in engineering," Mullen said. Slowly, the huge triangle began to rise. After 10 minutes, it stood upright, held in place by heavy ropes fastened to the ground on each side. The youngest team member, a 20-year-old Nevin Carling, shimmied up the truss and tied a piece of evergreen, called a wedding bush, to the top, a tradition thought to have originated in pre-Christian Scandinavia that gives thanks to the forest for providing the trees. When Carpenters Without Borders received the photos, François Calam, the group's founder, responded,
Formidable.
He called the truss an extraordinary gesture for us in France in the grand tradition of friendship between our countries. Some participants found themselves reflecting on another connection between the human ingenuity that gave rise to medieval cathedrals and the religious awe that inspired them. While the truss was still flat on the ground, Cardinal Wilton Gregory, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., walked onto the worksite, donned a hard hat, and said a Hail Mary, invoking the saint for which the French cathedral had been named. Then he joined the crew on the hoisting rope and pulled. 2 days later, the crew disassembled the truss and erected it in the lobby of the National Building Museum in Washington, where it wowed visitors for nearly 2 months. It spent March of 2021 at the Millennium Gate Museum in Atlanta. It's too early to say if the truss will ever travel to Paris as part of the reconstruction, but the Browns hold out hope. Some of us have compared this to when France gave America the Statue of Liberty, says Rick, and this would be a gift back to the French. That's a fascinating little short, kind of short story, my goodness, entitled Paris on the Potomac. And it's funny because even as I was reading that, the Statue of Liberty came to mind as a structure that has connected the United States and France for such a long time. Well, our next story is part of National Treasure, and it is a whole different take on another topic entirely. This is written by Amanda Petrusik. It's entitled Mother Country or Mother Country. Patsy Cline sported a homemade suit as spectacular as her voice. On January 21st, 1957, Patsy Cline made her national television debut on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which aired Monday nights on CBS. The show featured agents and managers from across the country presenting the latest artists they had signed. Cline's mother, Hilda Hensley, had pretended to be her manager to secure them a spot at the taping in New York City. Cline was 25 and nervous. If she didn't get a break soon, she might have to kiss country music goodbye. She had grown up singing in the choir of her Baptist church in Winchester, Virginia, and in 1955 had traveled to Nashville to record a few songs for Four Star Record, which later leased the tracks to Decca. But after a decade of hustling, including a few appearances on the Grand Ole Opry and countless nights singing at juke joints and on a local radio station, WINC, Cline still hadn't found traction in the industry. By all accounts, she and her mother were extremely close. Hilda had just been 16 when Patsy was born, and Patsy's father, Samuel Hensley, had abandoned the family when she was just a teenager. Together, Hilda and Patsy managed to support themselves. In 1953, Patsy married Gerald Cline, but 3 years later, they were separated and would divorce the following year. It had been a long road to that CBS soundstage. For that night, Cline's mother made her a pink ensemble sporting record-shaped wool patches with the names of her daughter's singles spelled out in pink rhinestones. Cline wore it often. Come on in on the left shoulder, poor man's roses on the right shoulder, stop the world on the left leg, walking after midnight on the back. Cline wore it often, including the following year in the parade for her hometown's annual Shenandoah Apple Blossom Festival. Her mother Hilda's creation is as spectacular as, perhaps even more beautiful for its handmade flourishes, the lilt of Hilda's stitching, the black piping. You can imagine Hilda beaming as she worked on the costume. Love is evident in every stitch. It shines brighter than any rhinestone. Mother's love. Well, the whole industry was moving in the sequined direction. She was right in style, or leading the style. Well, you've been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.